This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm Adam Howard, in today for David Remnick. If you came of age watching Spike Lee movies, as I did, or joints as he likes to call them, you quickly became familiar with his public persona. He was ambitious, uncompromising, and outspoken, and as far as his critics were concerned, maybe a little too outspoken. But Spike Lee was a groundbreaking voice, especially for black audiences. For some of us, we got to see the richness and complexity of our lives portrayed on screen for the very first time watching his films. His 40 years of filmmaking include classics like Malcolm X and Do the Right Thing, several documentaries, including a couple about Hurricane Katrina and New Orleans, and recent favorites like Black Klansman and The Five Bloods. And he's still making movies destined to stir the pot. The subject of his latest project? Former NFL quarterback Colin Kaepernick. Classic Spike Lee.
Thank you. Can I say something first before we start? It's Brooklyn in the house. Oh, now we can start.
David Remnick sat down the other day with Spike Lee at the New Yorker Festival. They began talking about Spike's father, the bassist and composer Bill Lee, died at age 94 this year.
In his time, your dad was the bass player that everybody wanted to play with. It's an amazing thing. Duke Ellington, Billie Holiday, Aretha Franklin. He played on It's All Over Now, Baby Blue with one Bob Dylan, John Lee Hooker, everybody. He was also...
First album, Gordon Lightfoot. First album by Simon and Garfunkel. He's on Puff the Magic Dragon. He's on bass with Peter Paul Mary. So my father was the top folk bassist, but his thing was jazz. And when Bob Dylan went electric, everybody went electric. And people wanted to continue to work with my father, but he didn't want to play electric bass.
He wanted to continue playing upright.
Yeah, upright.
He was a traditionalist.
So my mother, who every week used to shop at Bloomingdale's and Saks Fifth Avenue, that had to stop. Because there was no money coming into the house because my father refused to play electric bass. So mother had to work. She started teaching at St. Anne's in Brooklyn Heights.
What was your relationship like with your father? It got complicated at times. Talk about that.
Growing up and seeing the way my mother was working, coming home and cooking and cleaning for five crazy kids, and my father just be at this piano and just write music. But it wasn't until later that I saw that, you know, this is his life. You know, he was not going to play music that he didn't want to play. It was great that we were able to work together. And that conviction he had, you know, I've taken a lot of that some things just can't compromise.
What was it like to work with him on films? He did the music for, I don't know, several.
He did all my student films, and She's to Have It, School Days, Do the Right Thing, and Mo' Better Blues. What happened was is that my father did not believe in technology. So when you're doing a score, all right, this scene, Daddy, is 2 minutes long.
And only 2 minutes long, yeah.
And then we go in the studio, it's like, what are you doing? So that's when I had to bring in Terrence Blanchard, the great composer. But Terrence Blanchard played with Branford Marsalis on School Days, on Do the Right Thing, and Mo' Better Blues. When you see Denzel playing, that's Terrence playing. You see Wesley Snipes playing horn. That's Branford Marsalis.
Mm-hmm. Mo' Better Blues.
Personal, man.
Well, tell me what it was like growing up in your house. Was the discussion of music and art at forefront?
Anybody has seen the film Crooklyn, that is autobiographical. So that was our house.
Clinton! What? Don't answer me, what? Turn the goddamn TV off.
I'm watching the Knicks.
I don't care what it is, no TV on a school night.
She can scream what she wants. I'm watching this game.
Turn it off!
Ma, it's just a game.
Who is that?
That was Nate. It wasn't me, Mommy.
The TV's not
we lived in a very artistic household. So thank God our parents were like, you don't have, they said, whatever you want to do, just be good at it. So there wasn't like steering us away from the arts. And I think a lot of times when it comes to the arts, parents kill their children's dreams because art, you know, we're not spending all this money so you could make pottery, you know, or a poet or something. You know, you'd be a lawyer, doctor, whatever you want. So it was just natural that we would be in art, but it wasn't drawn in our head. My mother was taking me to movies a little. My father hated Hollywood movies, so I was my mother's date.
What would she take you to see? What first excited you on the screen?
James Bond. My mother was a big Sean Connery fan. Loved James Bond.
Who are you?
My name is Pussy Galore.
I must be dreaming.
Do you remember what movies started that were maybe a little on the higher on the food chain artistically than James Bond? Not that there's anything wrong with Goldfinger, but that you saw and you said, that's something I might want to do.
That didn't happen till college. I went to Marist College in Atlanta, Georgia. That I had to choose a major. So I chose mass communications, was film, TV, print journalism, radio.
That takes in a lot of area.
Mass communications. But film is what I feel film chose me, not the other way around.
But, you know, if you want to be a writer, forget the economics of it, you need a pencil. To be a film director, you need a whole bunch of other people. You need equipment. You need money. You need backing. And you need to be, to some degree, you need to be Napoleon. You've got to lead all these people. What in your personality drew you to being a film director as opposed to a novelist or a poet or a painter or whatever? Why did you express yourself through that?
Because film encompasses all those things you just nailed, that Neil, you just talked about. I was did my student films undergrad, and I knew I wanted to be a filmmaker, and I knew that whole thing of driving out to L.A., flying to L.A. and working way up for the mailroom doesn't work for black people. So I'm going to go to film school.
Yeah. And what at NYU Film School, who are you listening to? What are you watching that's starting to startle you and help you become you? What are you watching and listening to?
Everything. And that's, I really thank NYU Graduate Film School for introducing me to world cinema, because a lot of the great filmmakers, you know, even though I've seen some samurai films, I didn't know Kurosawa made them. So it was an introduction to world cinema. I know what the Hollywood stuff is, but I was introduced to different ways of thinking, different ways of making a film, not just the Hollywood system.
I think A.O. Scott said that She's Gotta Have It and Jim Jarmusch's first movie really set off the independent film movement.
For me, Jim Jarmusch is my hero because I checked out equipment to him. And so even though Scorsese went to NYU and Oliver Stone, they weren't there when we were there. Mm-hmm. So when someone you know, you check equipment to, makes it, then it's doable.
So tell me about breaking through. She's Gotta Have It was made for
$150,000? $175,000.
Where'd you get the money?
Well, I was doing crowdfunding before there was crowdfunding. I had a pen in hand, postcards, and a stamp. Remember postcards? When was the last time you licked a stamp? And I just postcards everybody knew to help me get money. But what we did was,
in other words, you're hitting up your parents' friends.
Anybody knew.
Take me through the stages of getting through from the imagination to into a movie theater, and all of a sudden I go to a theater and I see, wow, this is something absolutely new.
Well, it almost killed me, but I had great, great people around me who believed in this dream. One of my classmates, I went to John Dewey High School in Coney Island, and his mother just died. And in insurance, he got $10,000. And he said, take it. I said, no guarantee, take it. And once the film became a hit, he bought a brownstone in Fort Greene. And is still collecting checks. And that film came out in 1986. So he got a brownstone, a very good price.
He certainly did. He certainly did. And where does this story come from? Had you been writing it?
She'd have it.
Yeah, she's got
it. She's have it. It really, the concept really comes from Rashomon, the great film by the great Japanese director Akira Kurosawa, where a rape happens and you see all these different characters get their version of that incident. And this is want to flip it. So three men speak to the camera and get their version of who they think Nola Dawn is, who's having a sexual relationship, all these three men at the same time.
What about Nola Dawn? What do you want to know? I thought she was a freak. You know, freaky dicky. You ask why did I continue to see her? I'm not crazy.
I think your career exploded even more with Do the Right Thing.
Okay. Mookie! So
what?
How come you got no brothers up on the wall?
Man, ask Sal, right?
Hey, Sal, how come you got no brothers up on the wall here?
You want brothers on the wall? Get your own place. You can do what you want to do. You can put your brothers and uncles and nieces and nephews, your stepfather, stepmother, whoever you want, you see? But this is my pizzeria. American Italians on the wall only.
Take it easy, man.
Huh? And you, hey.
Yeah, that might be fine, Sal, but you own this. Rarely do I see any American Italians eating in here. All I see is black folks. So since we spend much money here, we do have some say.
By that time...
That was my third film.
Right, and 1989. And by that time, was it a hell of a lot easier to get financing, or were you finding Hollywood still a tough nut to break?
It was easier. But I still can't get everything I want to make now. So, unless you're Spielberg or Christopher Nolan, and they're not just to give you a blank check. But I'm not complaining. I'm in my fourth decade as a filmmaker, and I'm not slowing down, not stopping.
Have you talked in the past about racism in Hollywood and other institutions. Has that changed at all in Hollywood? And if so, to what degree?
Well, there's many more people of color that are working in Hollywood today, in front of and behind the camera, but it's still not necessarily, you know, an even playing field. So the struggle continues.
Did you feel a special burden because of there was so few visible black directors in the 80s? In terms of representation?
No,
it was
a privilege because I was in a position to give people careers. I mean, a whole bunch of people came through 40 Acres in front of and behind the camera. And I remember we were getting ready to do Malcolm X, and the Teamsters at that point had no black Teamsters. So I had a meeting with the guy. I'm not going to say his name. I said, you got to get some black Teamsters. He says, well, we don't have any. Well, I said, you know what? Tomorrow the Food of Islam is going to be driving trucks. But they found some black Teamsters. Mm-hmm. They didn't want to mess with the fruit.
Do the Right Thing was not nominated for a Best Picture Award. And
Danny got it for Best Supporting Actor.
Yes, yes, indeed.
Lost out to Denzel for Glory. And I got it for screenplay. Dead Poets Society.
But it's not for Best Picture. And what?
Who knows what film won Best Picture that year?
I do. Driving Miss Daisy.
Driving Miss Motherfucking Daisy. Yeah.
What did you feel at that very moment?
Well, let's move many years ahead. Black Klansman. What, we got nominated for Best Picture for that, but what film won that year?
Green Book.
What?
Green Book.
Yeah, I was like, damn, every time somebody's driving somebody, I lose.
When you see one of your films visually, they're incredibly distinctive. And
that's not just me. That's the great cinematographer I've had to work over the years, too.
So there's something called a double dolly shot. A
double dolly shot. I did not invent it.
Okay, so double dolly shot, for those of you who don't know, but if you saw it and I was smart enough to have a film of it, you'd know it right away. It's when the center figure is kind of still and the background is moving very quickly and it's very disorienting.
They're floating.
And what is it? Tell me about it technically, and what are you using it for? What is it meant to do emotionally to the viewer? And you see it in Malcolm X. I mean, it's in a lot of films.
Ernest Dickerson, my brother, fellow classmate, great cinematographer. We were young out of film school, and so we're just doing film schooly shit and then showing off. And then Ernest and I said, you know what? We're out of film school. We're out of NYU. If we use this shot, it has to make sense. It has to be motivated. True story. So we're getting ready to do Malcolm X, and I became somewhat friends with the late, great Dr. Betty Shabazz, Malcolm's widow. And she told me that she felt that her husband, Malcolm, knew he was going to be assassinated when he went to Audubon. He wanted to be a martyr. So when she told me that, I said, Ernest, man, we got to find a place. So then it hit me. We have a scene where Malcolm, played by the great Denzel Washington, he's going to Audubon Ballroom. I said, that's where we got to do it. And then I said, we got to use that Sam Cooke song, A Change Has Come. And so that song, coupled with the circumstances and the double A shot, is the best use of it so far that we've done.
I was born by the river in a little tent. Oh, and just like the river.
But when we do it now, it has to be motivated.
Sparingly.
Yes.
Sparingly. Are there any other signature moves that you've either used or abandoned, or you think of as part of your film vocabulary?
We have a lot of time with people speaking to the camera. Double cuts where we repeat, like we might have somebody, if people hug, we might see them hug twice.
Mm-hmm.
Just try to be innovative with the camera and keep the camera moving and not just stand there.
Mm-hmm. Do you find it harder as you get older to come up with new stories, new material, or does life keep coming at you hard enough so that well is full?
No, I'm gonna have a plethora of ideals. It's the money, you know. You gotta finance that stuff. So
that's the big burden.
Yes, and my dream project is a film called Save Us, Joe Louis, which I co-wrote with the great Bud Schulberg. Bud Schulberg won an Oscar for On the Waterfront. Bud Schulberg is inducted into the Boxing Hall of Fame as a writer. And I got to know Bud. He introduced me to Kazan. And Bud was at the two Joe Louis Schmeling fights in Yankee Stadium. So this screenplay is about the relationship between Joe Louis and Max Schmeling, who was not a Nazi, but he was on the tyranny of Hitler.
In your vision of it, who would play those two actors? Those two roles, Schmeling and Louis.
I don't want to jinx it, but I co-wrote it with Bud, and for 2 years, Bud would call me every day. I mean, he was on his deathbed. He would call me, and what kept him alive was the idea that we're going to make this film together. And he was a Spike. Yeah, that, you know, you read Bud?
I knew him.
So, yeah. Spike, did you get the money yet? I'm working on it. So I made a promise to Bud on his deathbed, we're going to get this film made one day.
Now, you've been doing a lot of documentaries. I was honored to have the privilege to briefly be in a couple of them, one about New York City and one that's forthcoming about Colin Kaepernick. And you do this thing. It's really not disconcerting, but nerve-wracking. You put somebody in a chair, and the camera is about 2.5 feet from your face.
You were great.
And you're, yeah, we'll see. Right now you're doing Colin Kaepernick. How many hours of footage do you have?
Just
interviews?
Just over it, yeah.
Hundreds of hours.
And it's going to break down to what?
Five parts.
Of each an hour and a half, an hour and change. So who sits there and goes through over and over? That's all you? How collaborative
is that? No, what I do is that I look at the dailies with the editors, and then they go off and do what they got to do, and they show it to me. But it's, you got to put the work in. You can't fake the funk. And this documentary is taking a long time.
Why is that?
Story keeps going.
He's not coming to the Jets, I hate to tell you.
He might not ever play again.
This is the most important question I can possibly ask you. Why don't you organize a team to buy the Knicks?
They're not for sale.
Yeah, you could do it and make them better, because I got to tell you, I can't take it anymore. I don't know how you do
this.
We
haven't won in 50 years. The last year was the 72-73
season.
But we're going to be good this year.
Why are we going to be good this year again?
What did the Brooklyn faithful always do? What did the Flappers faithful always say?
Wait
till next year. Well, this is the year.
This is it.
This is the year.
From your lips to God's ears, I want to ask you some collaboration questions. Denzel Washington, what is the quality that you find in him that, and you bring it out in so many different films? Why is he as great with you? Not that he wasn't great in Equalizer 3, which I loved.
Yeah, I got nothing to do with that. Denzel, in my opinion, is the greatest living actor today. You could feel his power, his sensitivity, his humanity. And he just, the way he carries himself, like, he's not fucking around. And if you're on a set, whether you're a boom, whatever, I think you're not doing your job, he's going to let you know.
He lets you know?
Yeah.
How?
Spike.
That's good. That was good.
But you know how I direct Denzel? All right, Denzel, what do you want to do next? All right. Oh, okay, that's a great idea. Yeah, we'll do it. But he's the GOAT.
You're going to do another one with him?
I would love to.
You got anything in mind?
Not yet, but we're
talking.
Is he too
old to be Joe Louis? Okay.
Yeah. Played Hurricane Carter.
That's right. How long can you do this? You look at Scorsese's...
Kurosawa's 86.
Yeah.
I'm 66.
Is that the idea?
I got at least 20. I got to get the Kurosawa.
Gotcha. All right.
Got to.
Spike Lee, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. David Remnick, give it up for David.
Filmmaker Spike Lee talking with David Remnick at the New Yorker Festival. And if you've been an admirer of Spike Lee's movies over the years, you're definitely going to want to check out what he considers the list of essential films. There are 95 movies on this list, and some of them are movies you would totally expect to see, like The Godfather and Raging Bull. And of course, there's a few Kurosawas on there as well. But there's some surprises too, movies like Mad Max and Kung Fu Hustle, if you can believe it. You can find a link to Spike's list on our website, newyorkerradio.org. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm Adam Howard, sitting in for David Remnick, who's away this week. Fellow Travelers is a mini-series premiering on Showtime, set during a period that's not widely remembered now. We know the story of Joseph McCarthy going after supposed communists and the government, but alongside the Red Scare was a witch hunt that cost thousands of gay people their jobs.
The president is going to issue an EO, whatever that is.
Executive order. Come here.
And they're worried Eisenhower's trying to undermine them with it.
By taking the lead on the anti-communist crusade?
I think so. Senator McCarthy wants to ignore it, but Roy thinks that they should...
Roy? On a first-name basis?
Mr. Cohn thinks the smarter move is to make people think that they, McCarthy and Cohn, are behind the order. That they forced Eisenhower to do the right thing.
It was a grim situation. An investigation at the time claimed that, quote, one homosexual can pollute an entire government office. Fellow Travelers is based on a novel by Thomas Mallon. It describes real events through two fictional characters working in the government. They start a secret relationship while their lives in the Capitol brush up against the likes of McCarthy and the infamous Roy Cohn. Thomas Mallon spoke with David Remnick.
Tom, the relationship at the center of the book is a romance between two men, and this is Washington, D.C. in the 50s. Talk a little bit about what it meant to be gay back then, and maybe particularly in D.C. What did being an out gay man at that time really look like?
Well, it made life very claustrophobic and made life very dangerous. Washington, like a lot of big cities, was filled with people who had come from small towns so that they could live a bit more openly. But there were special strictures in Washington. The government was really on a tear when it came to dismissing gays, especially from the State Department, but really all over in the early 50s. So any gay romance had to be tremendously clandestine. And when I started writing this book around 2004, I was so aware of how much easier my life was because of a number of people in the 1950s who pushed back with a great deal more courage than I certainly would have had in that period and, you know, made my life much, much more livable.
Tell me about that. Who were they and what did that mean?
Well, the grand old man of gay rights in Washington, D.C. was Frank Kameny, who was an Army astronomer who was fired for, you know, the sort of men's room incident that would get you fired in those days.
I was called in by two Civil Service Commission investigators. They said, "We have information that leads us to believe that you're homosexual. Do you have any comment?" I said, "What's the information?" They said, "We can't tell you." I said, "Well, then I can't comment. And in any case, it's none of your business." So the Civil Service Commission had a provision, among others, denying jobs to those involved in immoral conduct. I was fired.
I met Frank toward the end of his life a couple of times. Frank was a very tough son of a bitch, and he was exactly what was needed. He was irascible, difficult. He picketed the White House in 1965.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and I always try to imagine, you know, LBJ and Lady Bird sort of looking at the window, you know, Johnson saying, "Bird, you won't believe this. You know, look what's out there." And they were carrying these very poignant picket signs saying that we were homosexual citizens. And he just chipped away and had courtroom defeat after courtroom defeat. But he persisted. And
what he was battling was both in real time and similar to McCarthyism, essentially. This is before Stonewall. This
right.
Is before—
there was definitely an overlap in the 50s. And when McCarthyism receded, the repressions of gay people who were government employees continued with gusto. And the book it's full of people trying to reconcile things which society and the government are telling them are irreconcilable, but the people themselves don't see any logical or moral reason why. I mean, Timothy is a
Explain who
fervent.
Who your characters are.
Yes.
Who is Timothy?
Timothy Laughlin is a young man who comes to Washington straight out of Fordham. And Hawkins Fuller, the man he becomes involved with who's a little older, is somebody who's out of Harvard, was a hero at the end of the war, and has exactly the kind of pedigree that Timothy didn't have, nor did I have. And Timothy was raised in this Irish Catholic milieu in New York. He's a fervent anti-communist, as I was certainly brought up to be. And he is very serious about his religion. But these things are supposedly so irreconcilable with his being gay that he is caught in this vice. And, you know, I stayed out of the television adaptation and let the screenwriter do his very good work.
This is the Showtime adaptation of your novel.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I had sort of learned to do that. There's also been an opera that's based on this book, which has had about a dozen different productions over the last half dozen years.
Who was there? Come on, name names. Vice President Nixon. Teddy Roosevelt's daughter, Mrs. Longworth. Senator John F. Kennedy.
McCarthy, that's efficiency. Married his office girl to crank out his baby.
And I stayed out of the hair of the librettist and the composer. The one conversation I recall having with the librettist was, just don't make the kid, meaning Timothy, just don't make the kid's politics and religion into a joke. Don't make them something that, well, you know, once he gets rid of that baggage,
the easy
he'll
ironing.
Be free and so forth. Because I think those things remained a craving for people.
Tom, tell me why you decided to write a novel about this rather than a history. I mean, you're capable of both and have written, thank God for us, nonfiction as well as fiction. Why do it in the form of fiction and historical fiction?
Yeah, like a lot of my novels, this one did begin with nonfiction or an attempt at nonfiction. We were coming up on the 50th anniversary of the Army-McCarthy hearings, and I had an idea for a magazine piece. Maybe it was for you. I can't remember if I pitched it to anybody. But I wanted to find out what had happened to Fred Fisher, who was the young lawyer about whom the famous question was asked of McCarthy, have you at long last no decency, sir?
Let us not assassinate this lad further, Senator. You've done enough. Have you no sense of decency, sir, at long last? Have you left no sense of decency?
And I thought that maybe writing about Fisher, who was a very young man at the time, might be a way into this period. It didn't work out that way. And yet I was doing all this reading about the period, and I began to imagine these characters. But I thought I could dramatize this story and dramatize a lot of concerns that were on my mind. My novels had hardly been replete with sex, let alone gay sex. And the gay sex here is meant to be very characterizing, and it's often quite explicit. And I think one of the things that actually helped me writing this book was I was exhausted a lot of the time I was writing it. And I think it was good for my emotions because I was not used to bringing my emotions, certainly into a gay love story. And, you know, I was a federal employee for a while. And I wrote this book, a lot of this book, at night. I would go down after dinner. I'd force myself to go down to the GW library, and I would write there. I remember a couple of times when I literally pushed the pad away from me. I still write longhand. I pushed it away from me, and I just, it was too much to bear, and it was on the verge of tears, whatever. I think it was good for the book.
You've talked at various times about how similar you are to Timothy Laughlin, who's the younger character in Fellow Travelers. And given that, you give him a pretty horrific ending. he leaves politics, he leaves the church, he's never has another relationship, and he dies after a painful battle with cancer.
I was determined to write a tragedy because there was no way to tell the story of these people who had been fired by the thousands. There was no way of telling that story without making my two fictional characters tragic figures.
I will say that the fate that meets Timothy Laughlin is quite different in the TV version, a much happier and fulfilled one.
And
if I can let the cat out of the bag, he's able to have a full life as an activist and be part of the gay community. And were you disappointed, or did you react well or poorly to the way TV treated your novel in that way?
I've only seen the first two episodes so far, but I liked them. And when there were these scenes set in the 50s between Hawk and Tim, I very much had the feeling, oh my gosh, those are my characters up there. I really sort of see this. But I think if you write historical fiction, you should face the fact that you are yourself an adapter. you know, by inserting these fictional people into actual history, you are changing, adapting, modifying history to begin with. So there's a certain inconsistency, I think, if you say, well, I want any filming of my book to, you know, produce a mirror image of the text.
I see.
And he had his own idea about what to do with things. And I think it's very fruitful and kind of natural. It's a much bigger thing, much more expansive.
Canvas, yeah.
Covers much more time than my novel does.
Tom, you left the Republican Party, I think, a few years ago. How much did a lack of support for gay rights affect your decision in the Republican Party?
It was actually Trump that drove me out of the party, but insofar as I had been a registered Republican, I was never happy with the Republican Party's issue on social issues, especially gay rights. And I never hid that opposition. But I was bifurcated in some ways. My politics when it came to things like foreign policy were relatively conservative. And I had to make choices. I would have had to make the same choices in the Democratic Party. Politics has never been easy for me. It's always been a matter of tension between values that don't accommodate themselves to one party or another.
Tom, your book begins and ends in 1991 during the AIDS crisis. I bring that up only because last year we published excerpts from your astonishing diaries during that time. And I'd ask that you read a section from that for us.
Okay, yes. This entry was made Saturday, February 13th, 1988. Came home with the Times tonight, a front page article on how the virus isn't spreading to many gay men anymore, so safe sex apparently is safe, but how a great harvest of souls is imminent. They actually say that a large portion of the gay male population in San Francisco and New York will be, quote, wiped out over the next several years. Everyone who got the virus in the early 80s, did I get it 5 years ago next week? We'll be dying. Or nearly everyone. And you know what this means. Since the virus has stopped spreading and heterosexuals are safe, the search for a cure will slow. The dying will be allowed to die. Nature's adjustment of the surplus perverted population. Gays won't be extinct. They'll just be reduced and contained. In their secret hearts, many people will think the shriving a good thing. And will I be gathered in with the quarter of a million still to die? I tell myself I want only to finish these two books. Let me see them done and out, and then I'll go quietly. That's what I tell myself anyway.
God, what a horrifying thing. It's just so painful to read that. I can't imagine what it was like to write it and live it. What surprised you when you went back through those diaries? Had you looked at them in a long time?
I had never reread my diaries from the 80s. And my diaries are voluminous. I mean, Peeps was like a tweeter compared to me. They go on and on for 50 years.
The collected tweets of Samuel Peeps.
And but my papers, sort of like Frank Kameny's, my papers have now gone to the Library of Congress, including all these diaries. But before they went, I always knew I wanted to make a book out of the diaries. And so my partner and I, Bill, and I've been lucky enough after an entry like that. I mean, Bill and I have been together for 35 years. We scanned them. It was an enormous project so that I could work with them without having to go to Capitol Hill to read my own diaries. But I don't think I had ever reread that passage until I was trying to extract a piece for The New Yorker. It was a harrowing experience to publish that piece.
It's just imbued with fear and anxiety and funeral after funeral after funeral.
Yeah. And I was a worrier by nature. My disposition is sunny enough, but I'm constantly anxious.
When could you stop worrying about AIDS for yourself?
Well, a lot of the drama in the excerpt that you published was about whether or not to take the test.
Right.
And today, I think that sort of surprises people because if you are at all concerned with your own sexual health and others, you take that test. But at the time, you could get the news and there would be nothing they could do for you. You know, I mean, AZT was coming in, but the side effects of AZT sometimes seemed worse than the disease. Even, I mean, Larry Kramer, who was, of course, a fierce activist, there was a period in the late 80s when he was saying, don't take the test. Why have this sword of Damocles hanging over your head when there's nothing they're going to do for you? So I didn't take the test until 1990 or 91. And by that time, and even before that, one knew how to behave, to protect oneself. I don't mean behave in the sense of to, you know, good behavior. One knew how physically to protect oneself. Sure. But it was just constant bad news. One of the things that I was struck by when I read the diaries, that whole stretch of them out of which the excerpt came, I was struck by a manic quality to the diaries. And I don't think of myself as a manic person, but I was in New York in the 1980s, very happy about a lot of things. I was getting a little bit of traction as a writer, and I was sort of living my 20s in my 30s. And I was enjoying getting published in certain places, starting to write my books, whatever, and I would enthuse about all of that. And then the next entry, there'd be this crash landing because some horrible piece of news had come in. And the next day, I'd pick myself up, and it would go like that. And the sine curve of it is much sort of more alpine than the other decades in my life have been.
Tom Mellon, it's a privilege to talk to you, just as it is to publish you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, David.
That's the writer Thomas Mellon talking to David Remnick. You can read Mellon's piece called Finding My Way and Staying Alive During the AIDS Crisis at NewYorker.com. Mellon is the author of more than a dozen books, and Fellow Travelers premieres on Showtime next week. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm Adam Howard, sitting in for David Remnick, who's away this week. Believe it or not, there are things happening in the world of sports right now besides the budding romance of Travis Kelce and Taylor Swift. Seriously. The NBA season is starting, and there's a host of stories and subplots to delve into, even if you are not a devoted basketball fan. Although I definitely am. So before this hour is up, I'm going to catch up with staff writer Louisa Thomas. She covers sports for The New Yorker, and I wanted to find out what, and most importantly, who, she's watching this season. Louisa, full disclosure, I'm going into this conversation a beleaguered and embittered Brooklyn Nets fan.
Okay,
so clearly my team is not probably going to contend for anything this year, but I am curious that somebody like myself, who maybe their team doesn't have much going on, what are some storylines and personalities that folks should be, you know, keeping tabs on?
You know, it's still LeBron James's NBA until he decides otherwise. You know, LeBron James even teased the idea that he might not come back. He was pretty worn out.
He was fallible.
He was fallible. He was human.
Right. He's going to be turning 39 this year.
That's
correct?
Right.
Which in NBA world is sort of a senior citizen.
Oh, he's the oldest player in the league. Not just old. He's the oldest.
I know he used to talk about like lasting long enough to play with his son, Bronny. Do you think that's still something he's realistically hoping to do?
Well, you know, that depends on a lot of things, not least Bronny. Bronny had a really scary cardiac arrest. He's set to play for USC. And who knows how that figures into James's play this season. He's actually dedicated the season to Bronny, but I haven't heard that kind of talk from James or that kind of pressure, certainly. As someone who was recently 39, I wake up, you know, I wake up hurting for no reason. So, you know, he has done more than anybody in the game and, you know, as much as anyone in the history of sports, I will say, you know, to kind of spend the resources to do everything he can to put his body in perfect condition.
Who do you think is emerging as sort of the would-be heir apparent to his mantle as sort of the face of the NBA?
I don't think it's fair to say that any person is the next LeBron James, just as it wasn't fair to LeBron James to say that he was the next Michael Jordan. But there are these kind of really thrilling, you know, stars in the league. We haven't mentioned Nikola Jokic, who is this, the best player in the world.
Oh, sure, sure.
Absolutely tremendous. Lee Weird, tremendous basketball player. He plays the Denver Nuggets. They are the
Serbian, right?
He is Serbian. He's from a small town called Sombor. He is really into horse racing, harness racing, water polo, probably. He's probably in water polo. I know that because he's on his water polo passes as part of his arsenal, which is incredible. Everyone knows sort of to be ready at all times to catch the ball and shoot when he is coming up the floor.
Yeah, when I watched the NBA playoffs last year, I can't remember the last time I saw a player who just seemed so dominant. Yeah. And it was sort of just... He was undeniable.
Undeniable kind of just, is a great word.
But you just kind of really had to witness it.
The word that people use in the NBA is heliocentrism. The idea is like there's a sun around which, you know, the other planets revolve. And so one player is sort of doing the bulk of the work. Someone like Jokic is actually, it doesn't show up in that stat for him because he's actually not a ball hog. He's actually really fun to watch because it's actually watching someone like with this kind of like galactic brain. And if you sort of just follow him, you know, you sort of start to see things that, you know, you've never seen before. So I think that's even true of a lot of people who have been in the game a long time. That's one of the reasons why Jokic is kind of an exciting player, because he's sort of like opening new avenues. And that's exciting.
And one of the players who's making their debut this season and is also being very hyped is potentially sort of a game changer in terms of the way we watch the game, play the game, Victor Wembanyama, if I'm saying that name right.
Wembanyama.
Can you give us a little bit of background on who he is? Because apparently he's going to be a household name should he stay healthy.
That's true. Well, the always the caveat when we're talking about athletes.
Sure.
He's this French child. He's not a child. He's a grown man. But he's really
a kid
young.
Child man.
And he is, and he's still developing. So the first thing I'm going to say is that, you know, sometimes you hear the hype around him and you're like, whoa, he's going to be the MVP next year, you know, and he is, you know, it will be a surprise if he's an all-star, because he is really young and he is growing. And that's one of the most exciting things about him. He has this kind of just, he has infinitely long arms. And he is really, really tall. He's like over 7 feet tall, and, he can dribble. He can shoot off the dribble, which is really unusual for big men. He can play truly positionless basketball. You know, he is still sort of like learning how to utilize his skill. He's like, you know, one of these Swiss Army knife players who is like, do I use the scissors or do I use the nail file or do I use the knife? And the game is moving really fast. And so he's going to get tangled up sometimes. And he's also very, very, very skinny. So sort of some people like...
Yeah, I think you described him too as a noodle.
He's a noodle. But, you know, he actually uses that to his... advantage, because he has this way to sort of a way of sort of like slipping into these little spaces, even in the kind of crowd of paint, and emerging, you know, up around the rim with the ball. And he sort of like has this kind of hyper agility, which is almost like, it's like there's this looseness to him, which is really fun to watch.
As you may know, Spike Lee was on our show earlier. He's notoriously a lifelong Knicks fan. Our dear leader, David Remnick, is also apparently a Knicks fan to his like long chagrin. There's so many Knicks fans out there somehow. is there any reason for them to hope that this year will be any different than the 50 years that have preceded it?
I mean, like, what is hope exactly?
The New Yorker's Louisa Thomas. You can read her coverage of basketball and a plethora of other sports at newyorker.com. I'm Adam Howard. David Remnick will be back next week. Thanks for being with us. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbes of Toon Yards, with additional music by Louis Mitchell.
This week's episode was produced with assistance from Catherine Sterling, Amanda Miller, Nico Brown, Michael Etherington, and others from the New Yorker Festival.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.